Exodus chapter 21 verse 22 to chapter 22 verse 15. The 24th talk in a series on Exodus was presented by David Crabtree on March 26, 2017 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by David Crabtree and is being made available to you by Gutenberg College. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. Contributions to David Crabtree may be made at www.soundinterp.wordpress.com. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. Handout number 22, Exodus 21:22 to 22:15, accompanies this talk. Technical difficulties resulted in the loss of the first few minutes of this talk.
Wilderness, they arrive at Mount Sinai, and at Mount Sinai, God says that He will make of Israel a holy nation if they will obey Him. And they say, we will do whatever you say. And so God begins to give them His requirements. And those requirements start with the Ten Commandments, which God spoke audibly to the people of Israel. But that was a terrifying experience for them. And they said, let's not do it this way. It would be much better if you told Moses what you want of us, and then Moses can tell us. And that's the way that the rest of this goes down. So starting with chapter 21 then, these are the further requirements that God is placing on the people of Israel. And it continues on through chapter 23. And those are divided into two kinds of requirements that are being stated. The first are in the form of case law. If this happens, then this is what the punishment ought to be. Then it's going to switch, and it's going to be a set of statements made by God, which are just, this is what I want you to do. And there are no punishments that are listed with those. Those are to be self-enforced. Last time we got about halfway through that first half of the requirements where it's the case law, the mishpatim, and we will pick up where we left off at verse 22 and we'll make our way through the rest of the mishpatim, the rest of that first section of laws. So verse 22 of chapter 21. And if men struggle with each other and strike a woman with child so that she has a miscarriage, yet there is no further injury, he shall surely be fined as the woman's husband may demand of him, and he shall pay as the judges decide. But if there is any further injury, then you shall appoint as a penalty life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, bruise for bruise. Interestingly, this scenario, we've got this scenario, this hypothetical situation in which two men are fighting. The wife of one of them, who happens to be pregnant, intervenes, tries to break up the fight, and she becomes injured while the two men are struggling. And the question is, what then? What should happen in that kind of situation? It's a curious kind of situation. I mean, it's very specific, and it's one that, at least, it's not part of my experience. I haven't seen this happen. But apparently it was one that did happen. And this scenario, or one very similar to it, shows up in the law codes of almost all of the surrounding cultures. So this apparently was kind of a typical case law situation. If this situation happens, then this should be the judgment. And that was shared by the culture in the whole area. Umberto Casuto goes through and talks about what each of the different of the surrounding cultures did in this scenario. And I'm going to go through how each of the cultures handled this hypothetical situation. In Sumerian culture, so this is the oldest, this is going way back. This is Sumerian culture starts about 3,500 is a rough date, and then comes on up to about 2,000. In Sumerian law, then, given this particular scenario, it depends on whether the woman miscarries or not. If the woman miscarries, then and the woman is just injured, then there is a small fine that has to be paid. If she miscarries, then there is a much larger fine that has to be paid. In the Babylonian culture, so the Code of Hammurabi, it makes a distinction depending on whether the woman is a noble or a commoner. If the woman is noble and there is a miscarriage, then the offender pays a fine. If the woman dies, the noble woman dies, then the offender's daughter is killed. If, on the other hand, the woman is a commoner, then there is a monetary penalty for the miscarriage. Yeah, just a monetary penalty. In Assyrian culture, if the woman is a noble, then there is a fine, the offender is flogged, and then the offender is forced to do some labor. There's no mention of what happens if the woman dies in that case. If the woman is a commoner in Assyria, whatever the woman suffers, whatever injury she has, that is inflicted on the offender's wife, that same injury. And if there is a miscarriage, then the offender apparently is put to death, but the text is not entirely legible there, so that's not certain. In Hittite culture, there's no distinction on the basis of their social standing, but for a miscarriage, there's a fine, and then there's no mention of what happens if the woman dies. Okay. In our text, then, some commentator pointed out that it's not clear in this case whether we're talking about a child that is born early or whether it's an actual miscarriage. But I think, given the other scenarios and the surrounding cultures where it's always talking about an actual miscarriage, I suspect that that is the case here. The Hebrew just says, if any mischief happens. But apparently that's a miscarriage, and the child doesn't survive. In this case, then, it says that there's just a miscarriage, there's no further injury, then he, the offender, shall surely be fined as the woman's husband may demand of him, and he shall pay as the judges decide. So apparently he then, the husband of the woman who has been injured, he proposes a penalty, and a judge has to approve that penalty. Then it goes on to say, and this is, you've all heard this verse, but if there is any further injury, then you shall appoint as a penalty life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, etc. Interestingly, this is not unique to the Bible, that this same list of equivalencies occurs in the Code of Hammurabi and in some of the other codes in the surrounding cultures. So this became kind of a stock phrase to use. And it is thought that originally this was taken literally. That is to say, if someone is deprived of a hand, if there's a fight or something and a hand is chopped off, then the offender's hand gets chopped off. So an equivalence of damage done to someone else, wrongly, damage done to the offender. And that seems to have been, they think, that that's the way that this was applied originally. But as time went on, we see more and more substitutions of a monetary fine in place of the chopping off of a hand. And the thinking seems to be, if I have been hurt by someone wrongly chopping off my hand, and the penalty is that person's hand gets chopped off, I haven't benefited from that. I still lost my hand, and I haven't benefited at all. I wanted justice, and there's a sense in which justice has been done, but I, in other respects, have not benefited from that. If I am given the option, my hand has been chopped off, I've been given the option of collecting some money for that in an amount that seems like it is an equivalent of my hand, then I have benefited from that, and justice has been done. And that seems to be the move that is made, in not just in the law code here, but that's the move that's made in the surrounding cultures as well. And interestingly, the term that's used for that is ransoming your hand. You are ransoming your hand. If you pay a fee, if your hand by all rights should be chopped off, but I pay a fee so that I don't get it chopped off, I have ransomed my hand or redeemed my hand. Okay. So that is apparently what... So this terminology that's used here, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, et cetera, et cetera, what that is doing is it's calling for a punishment that is proportional to the crime. Even at this time, it wasn't literal. It was just calling for proportionality. That the crime the penalty needs to fit the crime. Not too great a penalty and not too light a penalty. So this is just insisting that for that, the injury that happens to the woman, as the husband makes a demand of what would be a just settlement, this is stipulating it needs to be a just, a fair, a proportional penalty. Okay, Kasuto points out, comparing how the other cultures deal with this situation with how the law here is dealing with this particular hypothetical situation, he makes these observations. The first is, no differentiation is to be made on the basis of social class of the woman. All human beings are created equal. Some of them did make a distinction, others didn't, but in this section in Exodus, there is to be no distinction based on the social class of the woman involved. Second, the punishment is to be inflicted only on the man who causes the injury, but not on anyone else. His daughter or his wife is not to be punished for his deed, as the Mesopotamian laws ordained. So you notice there were a couple of instances where someone else was injured commensurate with the injury to the woman, and that third party wasn't involved in this whatsoever. In Exodus, there is no such kind of penalty that's inflicted on someone who wasn't involved. And the third thing that he points out is the penalty of the offender is to be determined according to the Torah principles. And that's, he's getting that from the eye and the eye, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, etc. The next, and I'll come back to some of those things in the conclusion. The next law verse 26 and 27. And if a man strikes the eye of his male or female slave and destroys it, he shall let him go free on account of his eye. And if he knocks out a tooth of his male or female slave, he shall let him go free on account of his tooth. The first question is, why is this law put in this spot in the text? And Kasuto is the one who pointed out, and I mentioned it earlier, that sometimes these are ordered by association, and sometimes just word association, because these laws were probably memorized, and as a way of memorizing them and going from one law to another, you had to have something to remind you. And here there's mention of an eye being poked out and a tooth being lost, and Kasuto suggests that the reason this is here is because of the mention of eye and tooth in the verse before. I think that's possible. I'm not sure that that's the reason here, but I think his principle that sometimes the laws are just strung together rather arbitrarily but by association, I think that is the case in some places. In any case, we've come back to talking about slaves, and what is said about the slaves is that if a man does permanent damage, so he pokes out an eye or he knocks out a tooth, it's an injury from which the slave cannot again be made whole. If that's the case, then it is required that the slave be allowed to go free. And that is true whether it is a male slave or a female slave. So no distinction on the basis of sex here. This is interesting in several respects. One is, typically in the laws in the surrounding areas, there was no penalty for injuring a slave. And the thinking was, why would there be a penalty placed on a master for doing harm to his property? I mean, it's like if one of you decided to take a chainsaw to your house and just start carving on it. Should there be any penalty for that? Well, there shouldn't be any penalty for that. The only person you're harming is yourself. You're doing damage to your own property. So the logic behind it is there's no wrong being done. Any damage that's being done is being done to your own property. So there was no penalty for doing damage to your slaves. But here what we see is there is penalty. The slave goes free if you do permanent damage to that slave. Why? Because that slave is a person and has value as a person. It's not just property. But notice how this is in tension with what it had said in verse 21, going back. We talked about this last time. But in verse 20 and 21, it says, "And if a man strikes his male or female slave with a rod, and he dies at his hand, he shall be punished. If, however, he," that is the slave, "survives a day or two, no vengeance shall be taken, for he is his property." So there is this tension in the law that we see right before us as to how a slave should be viewed. Is a slave the master's property? And therefore, whatever damage is done to a slave, that's the master doing damage to his own stuff, and there's no crime involved. Or is the slave a person? And if permanent damage is done to that person, then that person should be allowed to go free. So there's tension. Which is a slave, property or a person? And that I talked about that a little bit last time. that I think that tension is there on purpose. That's what Jonathan Sarna suggested, and I think he's right. The next law, verse 28. And if an ox gores a man or a woman to death, the ox shall surely be stoned, and its flesh shall not be eaten. But the owner of the ox shall go unpunished. If, however, an ox was previously in the habit of goring, and its owner has been warned, yet he does not confine it, and it kills a man or a woman, the ox shall be stoned, and its owner also shall be put to death. If a ransom is demanded of him, then he shall give for the redemption of his life whatever is demanded of him. Whether it gores a son or a daughter, it shall be done to him according to the same rule. If the ox gores a male or a female slave, the owner shall give his or her master 30 shekels of silver, and the ox shall be stoned. So here is, and this is another scenario that's common in the ancient Near Eastern law codes. We have a situation in which an ox gores someone to death. An animal, a domesticated animal, kills someone. And it divides it into two classes. The situation can be divided depending on the circumstances. The first is one in which this is an unexpected behavior on the part of the ox. It does not have a history of goring people to death. If that's the case, or it doesn't, I shouldn't say it doesn't have a history of goring people to death. It doesn't have a history of goring people. If that's the case, then the animal is going to be punished because the animal has taken the life of a man. So once again, we see the value of human beings is being upheld here. It's people's lives are important things and need to be protected. The ox needs to be stoned, so it is executed, and it is executed in a way that in which the community takes part. And I think that's an interesting feature of execution in Israel. It's not one stone that kills the ox. There's not one person putting that ox to death, but it is the whole community that is putting that ox to death. So the ox is killed, but then the flesh of the ox cannot be eaten. So there's a sense in which the ox is unclean. I'll use that term, unclean. I don't know if that's technically the right term for it, but it can't be eaten. It's not appropriate for a holy people, which God is making the Israelites into, to eat the flesh of an animal that has killed a human being. This kind of emphasis on the human life, the sanctity of human life, you do not find in the surrounding law codes. They just see it as economic. There's an economic loss that's happened there, and it's usually treated in that way. In this situation where this behavior was unexpected, then the owner is not punished at all. However, the other class is when this ox has a habit of goring people. And if this ox has a habit of goring people, then in that case, again, the ox has to be stoned. The ox is put to death. But also, the owner is to be killed, is to be put to death. The owner shall also be put to death. However, and here's another place where this ransom idea comes in. If a ransom is demanded of him, then he shall give for the redemption of his life whatever is demanded of him. So whatever is deemed to be an appropriate ransom for his life, by all rights he should be put to death. But he's being given the option of continuing to live. He just has to pay a certain amount in ransom to redeem his life. And then he can go, then he goes free. Notice in this scenario that it makes it very explicit that it doesn't matter whether the victim is a child, an adult or a child. It doesn't matter whether it is male or female. And it doesn't matter if the victim is a slave or a freeman. In all of those cases, it is a human life, and as such, it is sacred. And the same penalty applies regardless of which those is. With the slave, however, it says that the owner shall give his or her master 30 shekels of silver, and the ox shall be stoned. So if it's a slave, it is a different penalty. And once again, we're running into that tension. Is a slave property or is a slave a person? And here the law is landing firmly on the fence. It's kind of a person and it's kind of property. And by the way, the amount of that fine of, 30 shekels, according to Sarna, that would be the amount that would be the fine in most of the surrounding countries for the death of an aristocrat, for a nobleman. Okay. Verse 33. And if a man opens a pit or digs a pit and does not cover it over, and an ox or a donkey falls into it, the owner of the pit shall make restitution. He shall give money to its owner, and the dead animal shall become his. So now we've got injury to an animal as a result of negligence. So someone's dug this pit, and they have left it unprotected, uncovered, unprotected, so that someone could come along and accidentally fall into it. And in this case, what's being considered is what happens if an animal falls into that. And the solution that is, the solution that's used there is that the owner of the pit must pay for the animal. However, the guy who dug the pit, who owns the pit, gets the carcass. So the amount that he's actually paying is the difference between the value of the live animal and the value of the dead animal. Verse 35. And if one man's ox hurts another's so that it dies, then they shall sell the live ox and divide the price equally. And also they shall divide the dead ox. Or if it is known that the ox was previously in the habit of goring, yet its owner has not confined it, he shall surely pay ox for ox, and the dead animal shall become his. So here is another situation in which a distinction is being made as to whether it's damage done by an ox, and there's a distinction made between those times in which the owner knows that the ox is prone to this and when he doesn't know. If he doesn't know, then they sell the live ox, that is, the ox that killed the other one. They sell it, and they sell the dead ox, put all that money in one pot and divide it in half. So it's treated basically as an accident. If it was known that the ox has done this in the past, then, and the owner hasn't confined it, then he pays ox for ox. So he pays the equivalent amount for the loss of that dead animal. And the dead animal becomes his as well. Chapter 22, verse 1. Now we're going to move to theft. If a man steals an ox or a sheep and slaughters it or sells it, he shall pay 5 oxen for the ox and 4 sheep for the sheep. If the thief is caught while breaking in and is struck so that he dies, there will be no blood guiltiness on his account. But if the sun has risen on him, there will be blood guiltiness on his account. He shall surely make restitution. If he owns nothing, then he shall be sold for his theft. If what he stole is actually found alive in his possession, whether an ox or a donkey or a sheep, he shall pay double. Okay, so in the case of theft, a man steals, he steals an ox or he steals sheep. His requirement is to pay several times fold back. Oh, that's if he slaughters it or if it's gone. So he steals it, and then he either kills it and eats it, or he sells it to somebody else. It is gone. It can't be recovered. In that case, he pays 5-fold for an ox and 4-fold for a sheep. If we skip down to verse 4, then if what he stole is actually found alive in his possession, whether an ox or a donkey or sheep, he shall pay double. So in that case, the animal can be, it's still alive, it's still there, it can be recovered and be given back. He just has to pay, the thief then only has to pay an amount equal to that which he had stolen. So it's less of a penalty if it's recoverable. What happens if the thief comes in at night to steal whatever he's stealing? If he comes in at night, the owner finds the thief in his house or in his property, and it's at night, and the owner kills the thief in the act of stealing, then there is no penalty to the owner. The owner is not held guilty of murder. And in this situation, presumably it is a self-defense kind of situation, or presumed to be a self-defense situation. If, however, the owner knows who the thief is, the thief gets away, and the owner comes across the thief in the daytime later and kills him, then he is guilty of murder because it is no longer a self-defense kind of situation. In any case, a thief who steals, he must make restitution. And if he is unable, if he doesn't have the resources to pay for the restitution, then he must sell himself into slavery in order to make restitution. Okay. Just out of interest, in the Code of Hammurabi, the treatment of thieves is much harsher. In the Code of Hammurabi, if the thief cannot pay restitution, he is put to death. He's not sold into slavery, he's put to death. In the Code of Hammurabi, if a thief breaks in and is prepared to kill in order to steal, then he is to be put to death, whether he kills anybody or not. So harsher terms in the Code of Hammurabi. Okay, now let's do 5, verse 5 through 6. If a man lets a field or a vineyard be grazed bare and lets his animal loose so that it grazes in another man's field, he shall make restitution from the best of his own field and the best of his own vineyard. If a fire breaks out and spreads to thorn bushes so that stacked grain or the standing grain or the field itself is consumed, he who started the fire shall surely make restitution. So we have two scenarios here in which someone has been negligent, and that has led to the loss on the part of someone else. The first one is a man allows his livestock to get loose and graze in another person's field or in their vineyards. And when that happens, then the one who allowed his animals to get out has to pay for all of the crop damage that was done. But if there were 3 bushels of grapes that were eaten by his livestock, the restitution that he pays is 3 bushels of his best grapes go to the other man. Or if he sets a fire and that spreads to the neighbor's stacks of grain, then he has to pay restitution for that because of his negligence. Verse 7 then. If a man gives his neighbor money or goods to keep for him, and it is stolen from the man's house, if the thief is caught, he shall pay double. If the thief is not caught, then the owner of the house shall appear before the judges to determine whether he laid his hands on the neighbor's property. For every breach of trust, whether it is for ox or donkey or sheep, for clothing, or for any lost thing about which one says, "This is it," the case of both parties shall come before the judges. He whom the judges condemn shall pay double to his neighbor. So this is talking about a situation in which someone entrusts some of his property to another person, and then something happens to it. While it's in the care of the person to which that property was entrusted. And then the question is, what happened to it? If the thief can be found, then that thief has to pay restitution. It's just as if that thief had stolen directly from the original owner. But if a thief can't be found, then the question is, what happened to it? Why is it gone? And in that case, the one who is entrusted with the goods has to appear, has to go before the judges. And they have to make a determination as to whether whether the guy who was taking care of the goods, whether he had actually stolen it or whether something else had happened. If he stole it, then he's treated just like a thief and pays restitution accordingly. Verse 10 then deals with not in a situation where goods are entrusted to someone else, but where someone borrows something. And presumably they're going to use it. Borrows animals. Presumably borrows those animals in order to use them. Verse 10. If a man gives his neighbor a donkey, an ox, a sheep, or any animal to keep for him, and it dies or is hurt or is driven away while no one is looking, an oath before the Lord shall be made by the two of them, that he has not laid hands on his neighbor's property, and its owner shall accept it, and he shall not make restitution. But if it is actually stolen from him, he shall make restitution to its owner. If it is all torn to pieces, let him bring it as evidence. He shall not make restitution for what has been torn to pieces. Okay, in this case, if something happens to the animal, then the one who borrowed it, he was supposed to be taking care of it, he must pay restitution to the owner. However, I'm sorry, I got ahead of myself. If it dies, is hurt, or is driven away, he has to take an oath that he did not steal the animal. And in that case, there's no restitution. But if he doesn't take an oath, then there is restitution. It's presumed that he stole it. If, however, it disappears, And he can bring proof that it was eaten, evidence that a wild animal had attacked it or something. Then, in that case, he pays no restitution. It was just an accident that occurred. Verse 14, if a man borrows anything from his neighbor and it is injured or dies while its owner is not with it, he shall make full restitution. If its owner is with it, he shall not make restitution. If it is hired, it came for its hire. So a man borrows an animal to use it. It's injured while the owner is not there. Then he has to pay full restitution. If the owner is there, then the owner has some responsibility and restitution is not made. And he is presumably benefiting from the rent that is paid for the use of the animal. Okay, the last one of the laws of the first part of the Mishpatim. And if a man seduces a virgin who is not engaged and lies with her, he must pay a dowry for her to be his wife. For her father absolutely refuses to give her to him. If her father absolutely refuses to give her to him, he shall pay money equal to the dowry for virgins. So the scenario here is one in which a woman who is a virgin is seduced by a man. It is interesting that there are no laws that are laying out what is marriage and how marriage is established and all the how that's all supposed to happen. That is not laid out in the Old Testament law, and it was not the kind of issue that would have been addressed in the other law codes either. So what we have here is just an adjustment to established custom. All of that presumably was governed by established custom. The dowry, the mohar, is the money that is paid by the bridegroom to the father when a couple becomes engaged. And that is seen as compensation for the loss of the daughter. The daughter's getting married, is leaving the household, and that is seen as the payment of the man who is marrying her to the father for that loss. Interestingly, that money was customarily kept and paid back to the woman at a later date, years later. In order to be qualified to require a dowry, the woman has to be a virgin. If the woman is not a virgin, then no mahar needs to be paid at the time of marriage. So, in this kind of scenario, the woman would no longer be eligible for the dowry payment, the mahar. So, what is required is that the man has to pay this mohar to the father. If the woman and the man and the husband and the father, if the woman and the father consent, they can go ahead and marry. But according to Exodus here, the father has to consent. According to rabbinic tradition, the woman also has to consent before a marriage is allowed. Okay. That is the end then of what are the mishpatim, the case law. After this, it's going to be simply statements of what God requires. There will be three verses right at the beginning. They're a little bit different. We'll have to talk about those. But the rest of them are then just, this is what God requires. No punishments are listed whatsoever. And the ancient Near Eastern law codes have nothing like the second part here. They only have something like the first part here. I mentioned this last time, but I'll talk about this a little bit more. I think that it is very interesting, and it is a little surprising to me how similar these laws are to the laws in the surrounding cultures in the ancient Near East. I hadn't appreciated the extent to which Israel at this time, and as God is forming it as a society, there are some ways in which he is making it very distinct. But to a large extent, he is leaving it as just a part of that cultural web of the ancient Near East. And I think it's quite clear that God is not doing what I kind of in the back of my mind was thinking was happening here. God is not setting up the ideal society, a perfect society. Were he to be setting up a perfect society, I think that the laws with respect to slavery would have been different, but there would not have been slavery. And another example is the laws of the Old Testament allow for polygamy. If God were setting up the ideal society, there would not be provision for polygamy. But slavery and polygamy were both parts of the cultures at that time, and God doesn't just reach in and take those out wholesale. He does it differently. Instead of just reaching in and taking it out wholesale, he's building into the law some principles that those principles come into conflict one with another. There's tension that's built in here. And it's a tension that anyone who's trying to figure out what does God require of us is going to stumble over and try to figure out how do these fit together. And I think that God has set it up in such a way that over time it becomes clear that there are certain principles that take precedence over others, and that, for instance, slavery does not have a place in this system. Ultimately, it doesn't have a place, and it has to go. I think the same could be said of polygamy. Ultimately, it does not fit, and it has to go. But what God is doing is giving to the Israelites the project of trying to figure out these principles and work them all out, and in so doing, they're going to run into these difficulties, and they're going to have to figure out how to work it out. How do these things all fit together? Some of the things, so what God is doing here is giving them an assignment and kind of nudging them in certain directions. And so there are important values that come out in these adjustments that God is making to the cultural understanding of what right and wrong is. And let me list the ones that, and I will be repeating a little bit what Umberto Casuto said and adding a few others. Here are some of the most important adjustments. First of all, every human life is sacred before God. It doesn't depend on social position. It transcends distinctions based on social status. It transcends distinctions based on sex. It transcends distinctions based on age. That human life is inherently valuable. And this is a sharp distinction from the surrounding cultures. They tend to devalue the lives of some people on all of those bases. And it seems to me that, interestingly, our society is still trying to work out what this means. What is the value of a human life? The second thing, there were lighter punishments for some crimes than was true in the surrounding cultures. Just one example, in the Code of Hammurabi, thieves that came in threateningly were to be put to death. In the law here, if they don't actually kill anyone, then they are not put to death. So for some punishments, for some crimes, the punishments are lighter in what we see here. But in other instances, the crimes are much, or the punishments are much more severe. And they tend to be those in which there is a crime against God or his established order. The first four of the Ten Commandments all had to do with who God is and how we ought to relate to him. And dishonoring parents, according to the law here, merits death. And that is, you don't see that in any of the surrounding cultures. That's very different. And the punishment for a crime should fall on the perpetrator alone. So that we see a movement away from a family or a tribe-based society in which a whole family is held culpable for the crime of a member of that family. We're moving away from that. People are accountable, responsible for their own actions, but no one else can be punished for the actions of one individual. Okay, and clearly this is not a comprehensive law code, as I've mentioned before, and the order of presentation does not seem to be sacrosanct. However, the order of presentation that we see here is clearer than the order of presentation in some of the laws of the surrounding cultures. I think that it is very interesting that God would do things the way that he did them. That he seems to have given the Israelites not the perfect society, but it gave them an assignment to figure out how to fit together God's principles into a coherent whole. And as a result, then, they didn't have a perfect society. They had to work towards even understanding what that perfect society would be. God could have given them the laws that describe a perfectly just society and just taken slavery out of it, polygamy out of it, etc., etc. But that's not what he did. And that suggests to me that there is something really valuable about that process that a person or a group of people go through of wrestling with how do we understand what God requires of us, and how do we put that all together into a coherent whole? And how do we struggle with the imperfections that we have in our midst? And as I've thought about it, it seems to me that this fits very well with what he does with us as individuals. That is, as we come to belief and come to value what God values, and we want to live our lives consistent with what God values and therefore understand how those all fit together. What is God's hierarchy of values, and how do I live that out in whatever circumstances I find myself in? He has made that a difficult process, a process where you have to really work hard at thinking it through, figuring out what to do. And it's often very confusing and murky in my experience. But there must be something valuable in that process. So valuable that God doesn't want to short-circuit it. That he wants us to go through that and experience that and wrestle with it. Okay. Questions or comments?
This would drive me nuts.
What's this?
This the way the law is written.
Yeah.
Because it seems to demand that the first law you have to have is you must love your neighbor as yourself. Because when anyone starts to interpret the spirit of the law, it becomes very self-serving, right? Mm-hmm. So I didn't hit my slave and break his tooth. Mm-hmm. I just whipped him to death. Mm-hmm. Right. But the spirit of the law is, and then the other guy says, well, I can't read spirit, but I can read the words here in the law. And then it immediately breaks down.
Right.
So if there isn't a community spirit, a community ethos of you know, cooperation, collaboration, but everybody knows you don't whip a slave to death. He's a human being. Mm-hmm. I mean, this other law says even if your ox kills a slave, you're put to death.
Right.
So clearly, I mean, you're saying you got it.
Right.
It bounces back and forth, and it would be chaos if every person had the opportunity to claim, I kept the letter of the law.
Right.
Which is very Muslim. Right? I mean, that's, mm-hmm. and it's very Pharisaical. Mm-hmm. And I see why, I understand why, or the mentality that Phariseeism appeals to.
Yep.
I mean, it's there. It's
right.
It almost is set up to reveal those people.
Right.
To the community.
Right.
And the other question, I did have a question about if you have a field or a...
Well, maybe, can I respond to that? Yeah. I think that's absolutely right. And that's... I've been thinking about that as I've been going through this, and as I've thought about it, I've been disturbed the same way that you are disturbed, that to someone who wants to look at the law through the eyes of how do I find a loophole, there are loopholes to drive a truck through here. The law clearly was not written to people who want to find loopholes. It was written to people who want to understand what God requires. And even to those people who really want to understand what God requires, it is a hard process to sort this out and figure out what the hierarchy of values is. And I can understand how that's a project that's going to take a community of people a number of years to hammer out and sort out what takes priority here and how do we know and why should that be, et cetera. But I really like the analogy of a parent and a child that I talked about a few weeks ago. And I think this fits that very, very well. That as a child, you have commands that your parent has given. You have instructions that your parent has given. You have seen your parent in action. You've seen your parent deal with you. You've seen your parent deal with your siblings. And you take all of that abundant information. And you have to do that, the same thing that I'm talking about here, figure out how is my parent looking at the world that makes sense of all these things that my parent has said and done. A huge project, but if it's important enough to a person, it can be done. Children do it all the time, more or less well, and more or less wanting to know what their parents really value so that they can value those same things, right? Because a child can do it for other reasons, and clearly that happens. But for a child that really wants to know what their parent values, and because they want to embrace those same values themselves, that's a big project, but it can be done. And that seems to be the kind of project that was assigned to the people of Israel.
And it unfolds.
Absolutely. Over time, it becomes clearer through the experience of God relating to Israel, it becomes clear where those, what are, how do you rank those values, those different values that show up in the law?
It seems like another thing I notice is all these laws so far are applicable, except the one about if you have a vineyard or a field, because these people are on the move.
Right.
And
right.
So where did that come from?
Right. Right.
I mean, that won't make any sense until they're actually established.
Well, it'll make sense, right? Yeah. It'll make sense. It just isn't applicable until they're established. And one of the differences that you'll see between Exodus and Deuteronomy is Deuteronomy has a lot more of those laws that are appropriate for an agricultural society rather than nomads. We don't have many of those here, but there are a lot of those in Deuteronomy. So the law develops as their context, their cultural situation develops, which would make all kinds of sense given the model that I've laid out. Anything else?
Just occurred to me that God having given this task to the Israelites to figure out, they don't do a real good job figuring it out. And then Jesus comes along, and apparently he studies real hard, and he comes to some conclusions about what they should have been figuring, what they should have gotten from all this.
Right.
And that makes a lot of sense as him being called the final prophet, the one who like makes clear all the things that God left as puzzles to be figured out.
Mm-hmm. Right. No, I think that's right. But it seems to me that progress was made, that insightful people along the way were able to put a lot of pieces together. And I suspect that Jesus even built on that, what they had learned with respect to that. Okay, thanks.